Good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to the program today. We've got a really great program for you. I know I say that every single show, but we just keep bringing in great guests, and I'm really looking forward to introducing our guests that we have tonight. Before we do that, though, I do want to bring on board my co-host and esteemed responder in her own right, Sam Bradley.
Hi, Jamie. I don't know about you, but I'm still recovering from Nashville down in Joe's part of the world, and it was too cold there for me. I don't know. Of course, you're from the East Coast, so it probably wasn't so for you. But we have Dr. Joe with us. Hi, Joe.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Glad to hear your voice again, even though it was more fun seeing you in person.
Yep.
Yeah, definitely. We had a great time there, didn't we?
We did. And I have a really special guest. We've talked a lot about cop-related stuff in part of our extended world of EMS, fire, hospital, disaster, USAR, and so forth, and an active shooter and the kind of things we do to train with police. But we've never actually had one, and now we do. And I'm really excited about talking to him because I have so many questions for him. I'll have to give the official title. Lieutenant Randy Sutton, retired. And he has on the streets for 34 years. I got so many questions for Randy, I can't believe it. He's an actor. He was in the movie Casino and a number of others. He's the one that talked Sharon Stone off the, I guess, from committing suicide in the movie. He's a writer. He's got a couple books out. He speaks on police ethics and celebrating American heroes. And he had an interesting event while he was working. It's called a CVA or a stroke. And I'm kind of interested in what that day was like for you, Randy. And I think first, you know, we always like to start the show with some breaking news. And of course, nothing is going to eclipse what's going on in Missouri right now. So we want to kind of throw that out. I mean, we sat at the firehouse today having lunch, kind of trying to catch up on what was going on, but it was just too overwhelming. But the issue is it's a man-made disaster, and it's affecting many different parts of the country. I couldn't even begin to conceptualize all of the parts involved. I know, Joe, why don't you, you know, you can talk a little bit about what's going on in Tennessee, but how are you feeling about this, Randy? What's that like for you, just hearing all of this going on around you? And it's kind of bringing up some old experiences for you, I'm sure.
Oh, that it is. I've been watching this. In fact, I don't know if you're aware of this, but I actually went to Ferguson and officers down there in August when this whole debacle was first beginning. I have a certain affinity for law enforcement, of course, having spent 34 years as a cop. But I can really put myself in the place of Officer Darren Wilson as a survivor of 5 officer-involved shootings myself, and also having been accused of committing murder during an incident where an individual threw himself out of a window trying to escape from myself and my partner during a domestic dispute where he was beating his wife, and he literally jumped out of the window to get away from us.
Wow.
When he did that, he broke his neck, and he lived long enough to struggle a little bit longer while we were trying to get him in handcuffs, and then died while we were putting him into custody. And it was a similar situation, white cops, black suspect, black area of town. And then the woman whose bacon we had just saved came running down the stairs and screamed that we threw him out of the window.
Oh, my God.
And I can tell you that that was an experience in my life that I will never forget, when I was literally accused of murdering a suspect. And it wasn't until she recanted and the physical evidence, you know, showed that it was impossible that we had done that. But it was an experience that remains with me. That was 25 years ago, and it has an effect on my life. So when I saw what was going on with Darren Wilson, there was no way in the world I believed any of those initial reports where the the witnesses, you know, said he was put his hands up and the cop murdered him in cold blood. It didn't make any sense whatsoever. And watching the mentality of the mob kind of mentality take place here, where they were basically calling for the lynching of this officer, it upset me so much that I went down to Ferguson. And I spoke to cops in that area in order to write a story for my blog on thepowerofLegacy.com. And any of your listeners that want to read that, come to my blog, thepowerofLegacy.com, and take a look at that story.
So we can file this under, you never know what people are going to do. And I guess that's kind of what a cop's life is about. To some extent, we have that in EMS. We never know what patients are going to do because they can turn on us. But for cops, it's even a bigger issue, especially when you're dealing with weapons and so forth.
Oh, absolutely it is. Because, every first responder has to live through things that can be very, very disagreeable to the soul. And when I say that, when you're a witness to death, when you're a witness to the pain that others are going through, when you are in a situation where you are responding to an emergency situation, it can have a dramatic effect on your life. And
yeah.
I don't know if you're aware of this, but I began my career of service as an EMT.
No, I did not know that.
And I was with the Princeton Rescue Squad when I was a young man, and even while I was still a police officer.
So you do understand a little about our world.
Oh, very much so.
Well, let's go back and talk a little about you and your history. I'm really intrigued with what happened to you when you had a stroke. Was that on duty?
It was. It was. Now, I've been a cop for 34 years, and as I said, even before that, I was an EMT. And actually, I have to credit that medical experience with recognizing what I was experiencing when I had the stroke in my police car at 2 o'clock in the morning on the Las Vegas Strip. And of all the incidents that I've had as a cop, there was nothing more frightening than realizing that I was having a stroke. And I was I quickly lost the ability. I actually felt my brain slowing down.
Really?
And I was the lieutenant. I was the watch commander. I was the highest ranking police officer on the street. And when I was a watch commander, I would take a young patrol officer with me so that he could see what a watch commander did during the shift. And also they could actually see that, their lieutenant actually worked a little bit down there. So when I had this young officer with me, it was the first time I'd ever rode with him. And we had just come from a death call. And it was a kind of a bizarre death call where this kid overdosed with all his buddies. They were taking a bunch of weird drugs and he overdosed, and they were all sitting around in a circle when he did so. And they all looked at each other. And do you remember that movie with John Travolta where the female had she died from an overdose, and they got an adrenaline shot and stuck it in her heart?
Yes, yes, yes.
All right. Well, these bozos had seen that movie.
And so
there's this guy who is overdosed in front of him. And one of them says, "Hey, dude, I my mother has an adrenaline shot. Let me go home and get it." So the kid got in his car and drove home, got the adrenaline shot, came back. And now this guy's been dead for like an hour between the time that he decided to try this and stuck the needle in this guy's heart. And they're all standing around thinking, like the movie, he's going to come back to life.
Oh, my.
And of course, he didn't. And they called the fire department. And the fire department got this story and called us. And I was the responding detectives. They had to share that with the watch commander. So I came down to the scene. And that was the scene we had just left when I had the stroke, and I actually felt my brain slowing down, stopped the police car in the middle of the street, and I said to this poor kid next to me, I said, "You're going to have to get me medical. I'm having a stroke." And he looked at me and thought I was, you know, he thought I was joking with him. And then I started speaking gibberish, and he realized I wasn't joking.
Whoa.
And, you know, I got to tell you, when your brain is communicating with your mouth, and it's not doing what your brain is telling it to do, it's really frightening. And then I got out of the car, and I lost complete control of my body, and I just went down. And
wow,
I'm on the pavement in full uniform. This poor kid is calling for help, calling for medical. And tourists are walking by, taking cell phone pictures of me while I'm laying prostrate on the. And this is the last memory that I have as an on-duty police officer. When the officer called in that I needed help, of course, police officers from all over the valley, you know, came over to help, and they were forming a protective ring around me. And somebody was taking a picture of me with their cell phone, and although I couldn't talk and I couldn't communicate, I heard this. This is my last on-duty memory. I heard one of my cops say, "If you don't get that camera out of his face, I'm going to take it off you and stick it up your ass."
Oh, my.
And I remember thinking, that's the Metro I know and love right there.
Wow. Wow. Joe, you ever heard a stroke described from the inside like that before?
No, I thought I was fascinated by it. You know, I have a lot of patients that might show up in the ED or something along those lines with, you know, with a lot of, you know, bizarre ways to interpret what's going on. But that one was pretty unique and pretty fascinating.
Well, the irony is he recognized it because he'd had EMT training. But would you not agree, Joe, that most of us would try to blow it off as something else other than when he started speaking gibberish and fell to the ground? I think it was blatantly obvious. But I mean, in an earlier stage when it was like, well, it could be, it could not be, we would tend to ignore it or try to blow it off as something else. But at least Randy was quite clear on what was going on. So how long was your recovery, Randy?
I was very, very fortunate. The clot, when they showed it on me, they showed it to me on the MRI. excuse me. The blood, the clot went into the area of my brain, which had, you know, the speech and also the memory, but it didn't stay long enough to do much permanent damage. The only permanent damage that I suffered was some memory loss and a little bit of forming words. That's every now and then it's a little difficult for me to remember a word. But other than that, I was extremely fortunate in that it didn't last that long.
I think we medical people are curious. Do you remember what therapy they gave you when you got into the ER?
You know, when they got me to a stroke center.
Oh, and, excellent.
And but they didn't give me, because I in my mind I expected, I forget what the name of the treatment is that they use for a stroke patient. But they didn't give it to me because the clot had already passed by the time I got to the hospital.
So that was the end of your police career, right?
That was effectively the end of my police career. They discovered through a bunch of medical tests, you know, they were trying to figure out what caused the stroke, of course. And unfortunately, they discovered that I had a serious heart condition that I did not know that I had. I had severe heart disease. And 3 weeks prior to my suffering the stroke, there had been a couple of incidents that probably, you know, were part of this. I lived with my mother. I brought her out to live with me after my dad died. And my mother had become terminally ill, and I was taking care of her. She was in home hospice care.
Mm-hmm.
And she and I took family leave to stay with her, and I took about a month off. And then she kind of rallied a little bit, and I was able to go back to work. And I was back at work maybe 2 weeks when I was called to the scene of an incident with an armed suspect, and wound up in an officer-involved shooting where we killed the suspect. And that was certainly not my first shooting, but at this point in my career, it was pretty devastating. And right after the investigation, when I was, of course, cleared of any issues, my mother passed away.
Oh, my.
And 3 weeks after that is when I had the stroke. So there was a number of incidents, I think, that led up to it. But when they discovered the medical condition, and it was basically the doctors told me they had to do heart surgery on me. And when they did, as they were releasing me from the hospital, the doctor sits on the edge of the bed, and he says, "Randy, how do you feel?" I said, "To tell you the truth, doc, I feel pretty damn good." And he said, I'm so glad, but I don't want you to be under the mistaken impression that anything we did here is going to preclude you from having another stroke or a heart attack."
Hmm.
And I looked at him, I said, "Well, then why'd you do the operation?" And he said, "Well, because it'll make you more comfortable." And I got to tell you, that's not exactly what I was hoping to hear.
Hmm.
So that led to... those incidents led to, a taking of stock of my life, and led to some, pretty significant changes in the way I view the world and also in my contributions that I hope to continue to give. But they were very correct, because 3 months later I was teaching a class and had another stroke.
Oh my gosh. As serious as the first one, or?
Not as serious as the first one. I just, okay. I didn't know who I was or where I was. And I'm in the middle of teaching this class to about 100 police officers in Indiana. And I literally didn't know who I was or where I was. And I just sat down on the floor, and they're all looking at me like I'm crazy, which I don't blame them for. And that's what it was. It was another stroke.
Well, what do you think, Joe? You're the medical guy here. You're the doctor. He's been quite a bit.
Works, I think, clearly I'm guessing a lot of that surgery was done to you must have had a septal defect or something along those lines that they needed to fix. We're continuing to have clots floating around there.
Yeah, for real. Well, you're a lucky guy. Hopefully that won't happen again. But I got to ask you this, though, Randy. You're talking about, you've been involved in five shootings, which is way more than most cops, as I understand it. And nobody really knows whether it's just, you justify it or not justify it, and there's always that argument. But how do you feel, even though you know it's a part of your job and it's something you needed to do to maybe save somebody else or yourself, or there's a reason you did it, but it can't make you feel good to know you did that, especially five times? That's got to be rough on you. And any cop, basically, is faced with that.
Absolutely. Less than 1% of police officers in the country during their entire career will ever fire their weapon in the line of duty. So to be involved in a fatal shooting or any shooting is an exception rather than the rule. When that reality hits a cop and you face police combat, it touches you on many different levels. It touches you emotionally. You're never quite the same. I can tell you that. You look at the world a little bit differently. My first fatal shooting, was a shooting that I should not, by all rights and by all circumstances, I should not have survived. Mm. It took place within about 2 feet, and it was an EDP. A guy had done so much methamphetamine that he started having hallucinations, and in these hallucinations, God had appointed him the ultimate ninja warrior. That's what he told his girlfriend before he went out. And he dressed all in black, and he armed himself with a shoulder holster and a pistol, a sword, bandoliers of ammunition, and he went out and started shooting the kids at a high school dance. And when he did that, I was literally right down the street when the call came out. And at first it sounded like a crazy call. We get, insane calls all the time that are not really true. So I expected, after I heard this initial thing, that this guy was dressed like he was, and I was there within a minute and a half, and he was, I confronted him. We wound up standing toe-to-toe, literally. My gun jammed after the first two shots. I was not wearing body armor.
Oh.
And he fired, I don't know how many times at me. And when the smoke cleared, I was alive. But by all rights, that was an event I should not have survived. And that was a life-changing event for me. That began a personal journey of discovery and of growth. Because we hear a lot about PTSD, and it is a very, very real disease.
Yep.
But not every traumatic incident results in traumatic disorder. It can also lead to post-traumatic growth. And that's something that's rarely talked about, but it's very real as well.
That's a great concept. I like that. So would I assume now, like you said, you went to Ferguson, are you now going out and talking to other officers and maybe taking what you've learned from this and sharing it with other people?
Oh, I've been speaking to police officers for years all over the country on the concept of policing with honor. Surviving your career ethically as well as emotionally and physically. And I've been doing that for years since I wrote an article when I was one of my jobs that I held when I was a police leader with Las Vegas was supervisor of advanced training for the department. And I wrote an article that called Policing with Honor, and it was picked up by all the national enforcement magazines, and I started getting phone calls asking if I spoke on the subject. So I put together a presentation, an 8-hour presentation, and I've been speaking to cops from all over the country. And along with my books, I'm very proud to say that I've touched the lives of a lot of cops, including a number of police officers who contacted me and said that they were going to commit suicide until they read or heard me speak or read my books.
Wow. And that's something that Joe and Jamie and I have talked about, because it is a reality in EMS and in hospital and police and fire. And we even talked about in Canada, there's been this huge explosion of suicides, and anything and anybody that can make a difference. And it's nice to know that you're able to make a difference. Maybe that's why you survived the shooting. You were meant to do something like that. So you're also a writer. You've written a couple books. Was that cathartic for you? I have one. I unfortunately haven't had a lot of time to read it. But was that cathartic for you? Is it elements of your own life in there? Is it completely fiction? What's that all about?
No, they were actually, yes, it was cathartic. My first book was called True Blue, Police Stories by Those Who Have Lived Them. And I had never
envision myself as a writer. But I had an incident that took place, a medical incident, as a matter of fact, where once again my emergency medical training played a significant role in the incident. And that is that I was a patrol sergeant, and one night I was driving by a fairly busy intersection, and I heard screaming. And I look over to where the screams are coming from, and there's a car up on the sidewalk, and people are running around screaming. And I radioed I'd be out with an unknown trouble call. And when I got out, I heard somebody scream, "Oh, my God, the baby's been shot." And there on the sidewalk is a one-month-old infant who's in a infancy, and she's been shot in the face.
Oh.
What happened was some gang punks pulled up next to her parents, and for absolutely no reason whatsoever, it was a gang initiation, opened fire on the car, and one of the bullets struck the baby in the face. Well, because I was there literally within a minute of the injury, I recognized that the baby wasn't breathing. I couldn't wait for emergency medical services because by the time, you know, the ambulance got there, she'd be dead. So the first patrol car that got there, I grabbed the baby up and cleared her airway because the bullet, when it hit her face, it choked her on all the flesh and debris. It went down her throat and choked her. So I was able to clear her airway and give her mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and CPR and brought her back.
And, wow.
That incident was so, it played such a significant role in my life that I wrote the story. I felt I had to write it. And I wrote the story. It's called Her Name Was Jackie. And put it in the drawer. I didn't know what to do with it. I had no intention to do anything with it, but I felt I had the need to write it. And it sat in the drawer for a couple of years until the World Trade Center attacks. And when I witnessed what happened in New York, I vowed to do something that could help the families of the officers who were killed, and at the same time, perhaps change the way the people view the police. And so I asked cops from all over the country to give me a story about their career that moved them. And then I put my story in there, which wound up winning first place for nonfiction in a national writing contest. And
that's excellent.
True Blue, Police Stories by Those Who Have Lived Them. And I donated every penny of those royalties to the Widows Orphans Fund for the cops who were killed in 9/11. And that's what began my writing career. And my next book is about to be published now, called The Power of Legacy.
Excellent, excellent.
Of America's most inspiring people.
Well, we don't have a whole lot of time. I've been taking over this conversation. Joe or Jamie, did you have a question in there for Randy?
Joe, go ahead. I'm sure you have some things you'd like to talk about.
Oh, I do. I'm actually fascinated by this legacy concept, and I'd really be interested in hearing a little bit more about sort of at a high level how you view that.
Well, you know, legacy has become probably the most motivating factor in my life now. When I was given basically the death sentence by the doctors, and after I had lost my mother, I really began considering about how I would be remembered, and how could I make sure that the memories of my parents would live on. And what has come from that has been a number of pretty important aspects of my life. One is this new book. I've been working on it for 2 years. I went around the country talking to people that have done absolutely amazing things with their lives, about who their personal heroes were that touched them, those who inspired them. And to give you a couple for instance, is one of the first people I interviewed was Frank Shankwitz, whose name you might not know, but whose deeds you do, is he created the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Wow.
And he did that when he was an Arizona Highway Patrol officer. And huh. his story is absolutely amazing. It's because he helped make a wish come true for a little boy with leukemia who was dying. And Frank had a near-death experience himself when he was struck by a drunk driver and killed, but brought back by a nurse who happened to be having to witness the act. And so that began his journey for what the meaning of his life was. And he created the Make-A-Wish Foundation, which has, of course, has touched the lives of millions of people around the world. Well, this book is full of stories about people like Frank. And it became my mission that I should help those stories be told. So that's part of how those experiences that I had at the end of my career touched me. But the other is something that I'm about to launch that I believe will touch the lives of millions of people, and that is called Celebrate with Legacy. And we've created some incredible technology. I've put literally every dime that I own into the creation of this technology that is going to allow people to create their personal legacies to pass on to future generations, written, audio, and digital form, and bring families closer together through the sharing of memories. And we are very, very close to launching this.
That's very cool. So give us the name of your website, and then Jamie can put that in the show notes so people can...
I actually have it up here. It's thelegacychallenge.com.
No, it's thepowerofLegacy.com.
ThepowerofLegacy.com. So the one is your book site.
That's correct. ThepowerofLegacy.com is my books, and Celebrating Legacy is the website that's going to be launched here very soon.
Okay, excellent. We'll make sure we have links to all that in the show notes. And, Randy, it's just a pleasure to have you here on the show, and maybe we can have you back on in a future episode because we'd love to have just kind of have that police officer perspective here. We talk a lot about working and training together as first responders so that we all can work better together in those difficult situations and scenes that we all come across. And we'd love to have your perspective on that in the future.
Anytime. Just let me know.
We will.
Okay.
Great. And Joe, I want to thank you as well. We couldn't do this without the support of Paragon Medical Education Group and the stuff you guys do with that interactive training and experience that you bring into the picture for helping people prepare for things like the active shooter drills and situations like that people encounter. And I'm sure you work with a lot of police officers in your realm as well.
Indeed, we do, and obviously we train with them quite a bit as well as part of our active shooter stuff. So it was great to have you on tonight, and thanks so much for being our guest. Fascinating show.
My pleasure. I wish your listeners a very happy Thanksgiving as I do.
Well, and then too, Randy. We invite people to our website to ask questions, and they may ask some questions of you if you're willing to. We can put you together. We can connect
Absolutely.
You, so
of
you
course.
Can answer those if you're willing to do that, and hopefully they will.
Not a problem at all.
Excellent.
My pleasure.
Great. Well, Randy, we want to thank you very much for coming on, and we'll be in touch with you. Okay.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Take care.
Thanks so much. Bye bye.
Well, I have to say that was just an impressive interview and discussion that we got to have there with Randy. Sam, thanks so much for putting us together with him.
Well, he was recommended to me, and I thought, we really would. It'd be nice to have the police perspective because we talk about them, but haven't talked to them. And boy, what a career he's had. Amazing. Hopefully we will get him back again.
Definitely. Joe, you know, it's we'll have to keep our eyes open. I know you've got some police officers as well that we probably need to have a little bit more of their perspective brought in here periodically on the show.
Oh, I agree completely. I think it's part of what is absolutely vital to the training is appreciating their perspective and how they see things and how they talk about things. And, you know, what they see is important. It's not necessarily what we see is important. So I think it was I was fascinated to hear his realization that his EMT training is what probably saved him from his stroke, which I think a lot of police officers never would have had that insight.
Good point.
Definitely. Joe, where can folks find you and Paragon Medical Education Group? Because I know they're probably hearing this and wondering how they can do this type of training and put these kind of things together so that they can train alongside the police officers and the other responders in their areas.
Well, certainly hope so. ParagonMedicalGroup.com and also on Facebook with the same name. And our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU.
Sam, how about you?
Well, I'm in the usual social media places on Facebook, Sam Bradley11 on Twitter. And certainly you can find me at the DisasterPodcast.com website.
And, of course, I'm Jamie Davis, the PodMedic, and that means you can find me under the handle PodMedic just about everywhere. And, you know, we just got back from EMS World Expo. We've got some great episodes coming up for you from EMS World Expo, so stay tuned for some things coming, some continued episodes that we have coming out from there. But we wanted to bring this particular episode to you because it just seemed to be topical with everything going on in Ferguson and with the responders and police officers there. So, you know, we wanted to make sure we got this particular message out to you. As always, make sure you come back and catch us at disasterpodcast.com. Leave a comment. If you have something you want to talk to Randy about or ask him about, you can, of course, probably get a hold of him by going over to his website, and there'll be links in the show notes for this episode. But you can also leave those questions directly on the Disaster Podcast site, and we'll have him come back and leave a response to you. So that way you can kind of share your common messages for everybody. And, you know, Sam and Joe, I really liked his concept of legacy. I think that's one of the things that drives me is to make sure that I'm giving back to the community that's helped me in so many ways. And it's probably one of the reasons I podcast and do the things I do. But I really liked that concept of making sure that you're realizing that type of legacy that you leave behind you.
Yeah, and it's... Yeah, and it's unfortunate that in some cases it takes almost losing your life, a life-threatening experience, to really realize, well, hey, what am I leaving behind? What do I want to leave behind? And that was a strong message for me. But, you know, on the Ferguson issue, too, we had the opportunity at Expo on different shows, in fact, to interview EMS people, to interview one of the physicians from the hospital that was involved there with some of the hospital folks. So we have several interviews in and around that as far as the EMS and the hospital response are concerned. So if you have an interest in that, be sure and catch those shows when they come up.
Yeah, and they'll all be coming out. If they aren't here on the Disaster Podcast, you can catch all of the segments that we recorded at EMS World Expo will be released over at blog.promednetwork.com. So all of our conferences, whenever we go to a conference, if you hear me or Sam or any of us in our feeds talk about going to a conference and doing some recording, that's where some of those recordings will be showing up, and you can always go there and check that out. You know, Sam, this has been a great discussion. I know we're going to have some more things coming up for you guys to wrap up the year. I can't believe it's Thanksgiving. So, as people are listening to this, it actually is going to come out on Thanksgiving Day, but we're actually recording a few days before that. But I hope you and Joe have a great Thanksgiving, and I'm thankful for the great people that doing a podcast has brought me in contact with, including you guys.
Well, and we can say we're about a year into this, and so it's sort of our anniversary. And Joe, it's been awesome working with you and Jim and with Jamie as well. And I appreciate the fact we've done this, and I feel pretty good about the content we put out, and I hope we can do this for a long time.
So do I. I really enjoyed it, and it's hard to believe it's been almost a year already. So,
yeah, good times. Well, Sam, why don't you wrap us up? I think that everything going on down in Ferguson, everything going on, the stories that we heard from Randy still teach us the same message about those unexpected occurrences, those disaster medicine opportunities that come along.
I agree. Boy, I hope we can get him back again. But it goes to show you, on whatever level and whoever you are, police, fire, EMS, disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.